If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, welcome to Word for Word. I'm your host, Lisa Dano Daniel. Today's guest grew up in Melbourne, the daughter of Salvation Army parents. Her leadership skills were honed early and then developed through her university years and then into her career, which has spanned unions, public service, public policy, and as CEO of various local governments in Victoria, Adelaide, and Brisbane. In 2010, she was made Officer of the Order of Australia for her services to local government and Brisbane, and was given the keys to the City of Brisbane for her service to the people of Brisbane. After moving to consultancy, my guest has worked in crisis management, led major reviews of local governments in New South Wales and Tasmania, and has been Director of Uniting Care Queensland. She's currently the chair of the Victorian Pride Centre. I've only touched on a select few of the contributions to society made by today's guest, and I welcome to Word for Word, Jude Munro. Welcome to Word for Word, Jude Munro.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Now, we're going to get to the bottom of your amazing career and a little bit about your personal life and sexuality and coming out and that sort of stuff, because that's what we talk about here at Word for Word. But let's go back to the start. Tell me a little bit about young Jude. Where did you grow up? Tell me about your family. Did you have siblings? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I grew up in inner Melbourne and I was born in a place called The Haven in North Fitzroy in Edinburgh Crescent. It's a very prestigious address, but it was a Salvation Army home and my mum gave birth to me there. And I grew up then in Burnley, North Melbourne, Yarraville, Newport, and then finally Port Melbourne, where I was from about, oh, I think, 6 or 7 years of age through till on and off to about 21.
They're pretty working class suburbs that you listed there. So you said that the Haven was a prestigious place. Was it that then?
Or is no, it, the Haven wasn't, but the address was. Oh. So if you think about the Edinburgh Gardens in North Fitzroy, how beautiful that crescent is. Well, one of the big grand homes must have been donated to the Salvation Army. My mum and dad were Salvation Army officers. They were very poor. Mum would stitch clothes together. I always had secondhand clothes, as lots of kids did in that post-war era. But the big thing that they did was set up, they were asked to develop a community centre in Port Melbourne. And it was directed towards older people, but also people who were really destitute, the homeless people. So we always had homeless people around our place. That was also from the Second World War when we lived in North Melbourne. I've got this memory of, which I've been told about, but also it's prompted. You know how that, you get that interaction between a memory, a dim memory, and also being prompted about something. And there were a whole lot of people sleeping around the outside of our place in North Melbourne, men, and I was reacting a little bit frightened of them coming home late one night with my mum, and mum just said, they feel safe here. So they were very welcoming people. Dad taught himself Italian and Greek and Turkish to welcome new migrants coming in to the big boats on Station Pier. They had both grown up in parts of Australia's country. So they represented the move to the city, that era when mum grew up in Snug in Tasmania and my dad in the Mallee in South Australia.
How did they meet? Living in, so, growing
in
up so differently.
In a Perth Salvation Army Corps. Dad was playing the organ and mum just, they fell in love, you know. It's just one of those things. He was a very studious, serious person. He had a great sense of humour as well, but he was that. But mum was this unbelievably gregarious person. And like when I was 8, I can remember just feeling absolutely shamefaced getting on a bus and mum would turn to the whole bus and Lisa, she'd say, "Good morning, everyone." like this, and I'd sort of, oh no, here we go again. And she'd start chatting to everyone. And then years later, when I was the CEO of Brisbane City Council, I got into a lift, and one morning I said, "Good morning, everyone." And I thought, oh, Alva's come back. Mum's come back.
Do you think when you're a youngster, you find that sort of behaviour embarrassing, or, you know?
Of course.
But when you're older, you look back on that and you go, oh, what an amazing talent to have.
Yeah, but also I think I realised that she lived inside me.
Oh, that's a good point.
Oh, no, she was living inside me.
That, did you get along well with your parents?
Yes, I did, very much so. And it was mostly a happy household. There'd sometimes be tensions between Mum and Dad, and often they would be about money. Mum had this saying that money was flat to stack, and my father would say it was round to make it go round. That were their, their two opposing philosophies. But, you know, we really made do. Mum would cook for 60 people, you know, just this beautiful home cooking, of course. And Dad and her had the first, or one of the first, delivered meals programs to older people in Australia. And Mum would cook them, and then Dad would ride around on his push bike delivering them, and sometimes I'd join him doing that. But, yeah, I love school. I was bright. I used to help other kids in the classroom. Yeah, I enjoyed life as a kid, you know. And then probably a bit later I was sort of an organiser. There was a story about me when I was four of organising the kids in the kindy. The kindergarten teacher told Mum that I organised them, and it was about equitable access to
the
kindergarten equipment, to the playground equipment. Oh, it's very funny.
Did you have siblings?
Yes, an older sister, and she's still alive, Barbara. She's 7.5 years older than me.
Okay, and your parents?
Oh, they passed on.
Passed away, yeah.
Yeah, Mum lived till she was nearly 96, and Dad died when he was 71.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, in this era, Dad probably would have lived through bypasses and, you know, all of the stents and everything else that they managed to stick in human beings.
So besides being an organiser, Jude, what were you like at school? Like, it sounds like you were a clever kid. Were you a popular kid? Did you like the other kids? How did you kind of mix with your fellow school kids?
Yeah, I was all of that. Yeah, and I think that popularity thing probably was more so in secondary school than primary school.
And did your sister go to the same school? But she was a little bit older. So,
oh, she was substantially older.
Yeah, so she would have been finished school by the time you started secondary school.
Yes. But we ended up going to having been to the same secondary school. She initially would have gone to other secondary schools, and with our moving around, and then she went to McRobb, and then I followed in her footsteps in that sense.
Mm. Were you similar personalities?
Vastly different.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
In what way?
I was out there trying things, doing stuff, and my sister is a quieter person than me. She's probably more reflective. She has a simpler faith than me. I don't have faith these days. I left the church when I realised that they didn't accept homosexuals. But also I left it because I lost faith. I regarded myself as a rationalist and a humanist. I'd read about humanism and Renaissance people, and I saw myself and figured that that's what I was, and there was no God, there was no spiritual being, that all of the goodness and the evil in the world came from within us, and you know, that's what we had to aspire to.
What age were you when you kind of went through that process of thinking?
14.
14, it's quite young to be reflective like that and to picture things.
And I was at this big Salvation Army Youth Congress, and this guy stood up and he was absolutely virulent against homosexuality. And I thought, no, this has solidified my view. And I articulated that as a loss of faith. when in fact both were happening. I didn't come out at that time, although I was out at school, but not with my parents.
What was your parents' response to you moving away from the faith?
Extraordinarily accommodating and accepting. That was my decision. I was always a child that knew her own mind, and it was almost like Maggie Thatcher. I wasn't for turning, really.
They sound fair people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, fair. I remember their net income was $15, and my father said, we're going to divide this three ways, because my sister had left home by that stage. You'll get $5 a week, Mum will get $5 a week, and I'll get $5 a week.
Do you know much about your grandparents? Can you see through the lines of your family where this social justice, sense of fairness, sense of looking after people who can't necessarily look after themselves comes from?
Oh, yeah. Mum had a really troubled childhood. A beautiful elder sister, but then, you know, the story of the wicked stepmother. My mother, she was born in the Royal Hobart Hospital, by repute, the first child to be born at the Royal Hobart Hospital, and she was only 4 pounds in weight, so she was tiny, preemie probably, and they kept her mother's coffin open, who died in childbirth with my mum. They kept her mother's coffin open for her to be, my mother to be buried. But as I said, she lived to a fine old age. Wow. So, yeah, she had a very difficult childhood. She was beaten. She was psychologically abused. But I think from that, she had a big wellspring of love. She was a hugely loving person.
Experiences like that could go either way, couldn't they? I mean, she could become bitter and judgmental.
No, clearly.
She's gone completely the other way and passed that down through other generations.
Mm.
What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you have any thoughts when you were, 12, 13, 14, 15? Was there any expectation from your parents about what you'd do when you left school?
No.
Given you were bright?
I wanted to be an agricultural scientist at one stage, but I was put off that.
Why is that?
Some bloke said, you'll be stuck in a research area. Girls don't, women don't go out into the field. And I was occupied at school less with academic studies as school went on and more with the chorals and the drama and, you know, doing things at school that were all of the extracurricular activities. And I was obsessed by women, of course, and young girls and teachers and all of that. So, you know.
Well, let's jump to that. Let's talk about sexuality and coming out and that sort of journey. At what age do you think you recall feeling a bit different to the other girls? I hate using that word different, but it kind of encapsulates it pretty well.
Oh, probably 9 or 10, I reckon.
Yeah, quite early.
Yeah. Well, I think my mum started menstruating young, and I did, and my sister did as well. So we were the biggest kids in class for a very short period of time.
And so at 9 or 10, did you know what it meant to be attracted to girls? Had you heard the word lesbian or gay
or any of those?
So you couldn't kind of name it, you just felt different.
But see, I'd grown up with this incredible self-confidence, so I knew it was fine.
Wow, that's I love hearing that, Jean.
Oh, no, I knew. Oh, no, this is me. This must be all right. And the love felt pure and gorgeous and sexual attraction felt good. I mean, I was never really sexually attracted to men. Later on, I probably had boyfriends. I think I was trying to count them up the other day. I think I had 3 or 4. But, you know, they were just good mates. You know, there was never anything more to it than that.
And you said before you were out at school at a pretty young age.
Yeah, I was.
And was that an announcement or?
I didn't need to be. Everyone knew that. I was always falling in love with other girls or with teachers, and so that was a well known thing.
And how was the school in response to that? Was there bullying, or you know, it was just accepted? This is Jude.
Yeah.
What about your parents?
I never came out to my mother ever, but Dad, when I was 18, I had a chat with him, and he just said, "Look, your mum's pretty simple. She won't understand. I do." And, you know, we love you. And he was very accepting.
And your sister?
Oh, no, that was
because
a different
she has more
story.
Faith.
Share, that was a different story. One stage she wrote to me, because she was posted all over Australia with her Salvation Army work, and she wrote to me saying, God has taught us to love the lovely and the unlovely.
Oh, lovely.
And so I didn't talk with her for about 6 years, but now we're good friends. But, you know, it's because I've learned over the years, Lisa, to try and let bitterness go, and that in the end, if you have bad relations with people, it sours your whole life. I've seen that with people. Family members get bitter and twisted, and it's just not for me. I'd sooner forgive and move on, really, or ask for forgiveness about things that I've done and move on.
Tell me about going to university. It sounds like it was a pretty vibrant kind of time to be at university. Put me in a decade in terms of...
Yeah, so I would have gone to uni in about 1970, and I was there on and off until about 75.
When you say on and off?
Oh, yeah. Some years I didn't attend as much as others. So I went to Melbourne Uni and did an arts degree, an honours arts degree, majoring in politics and philosophy. And that period of time was one of the women's liberation movement against uranium mining, the Vietnam War and the moratorium movement of Swanson Street, filled from Flinders Street Station right up to the top end, almost to the uni, with a solid mass of people, and then moving through the streets protesting about the Vietnam War with Dr. Jim Cairns leading that movement. And movement against uranium mining was a great issue too at the time, as the level of radioactivity and what it did to people health-wise and its longevity as a substance became clear, which we've seen subsequently with places like Chernobyl and the great Japanese catastrophes. So we've become, I think, more understanding about that. And in women's liberation, I love women's liberation because it was full of protest, but it was also hands-on in action. The creation of the Rape Crisis Centre here in Melbourne, the women's refuges, and we staffed those early days of women's refuges, and still today I have a connection with women's refuges. It's more oblique, but the family violence, anti-family violence movement I've supported. But, you know, there was a practicality about women's liberation. We wanted to support and help other women and stand up for our rights. Subsequently, in years later, which we might get to talk about, I was very active in other ways with women's liberation. And that then, around that same time, I started to get a real sense around homosexual law reform. I read the Wolfenden Report, and that's when I made my first moves into gay politics.
What do you make of the changes between, say, university in the 70s, which you had a direct experience of, and the sorts of protests that we have now? Like, it seems to me that in the 70s the streets were often full and there was active protest. And I really am taken by your comment about, you know, you would protest, but it was about action as well. What do you make of the current situation when, you know, when we're unhappy about something, sometimes we just get on a Facebook post and like it, or we fill in a, you know, we sign a petition or something. What do you make of the differences between sort of then and now? Just, you know, just a personal thoughts, obviously.
My observation about that is that we're so time poor now. Ticking something on or posting something on Facebook is just about all the time that we've got. I think life was a little bit more leisurely when I was at Melbourne Uni. I can recall sitting around endlessly in the lounge room at home just discussing issues, and that wasn't a soul experience. We were deep into consciousness raising, even the setting up of gay liberation. That was one of the first things we did, was to set up consciousness raising groups.
Tell me about that. Was that sort of, that sounds like it grew out of just discussions in someone's house?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I suppose my earliest days with protest about homosexual the need for homosexual law reform was, it's hard for me to place the year, but it was, I think it was October 1971, when I wrote a leaflet and typed it up and roneoed it. I went to the Salvation Army officer, how brazen was I, in South Melbourne, and asked to roneo off some leaflets. Oh, my goodness.
About homosexual reform?
About homosexual law reform.
Did you tell the officer?
No,
what you were doing?
No. No, not what I was doing. But it was just, it must have been me, just a sort of a forceful, courageous young person. But anyway, and that leaflet was based on the Wolfenden Report, and I remember it alluding to boys in the band, and that is that a copy of that leaflet is in the Australian Queer Archives. So from that day, that preceded Gay Liberation. A group of five of us that arose out of Society Five set up Gay Lib. I was the only woman who was one of those five co-founders of Gay Lib. And then we had our first meeting at the student lounge at Melbourne Uni, and there was about 40 people that came to that first meeting. I chaired the first meeting. And then we divided up over time into different activities, running dances, organising demonstrations. Dr. George Duncan was murdered on the at the Torrens River, and we protested about that in May 1972. You know, it was an evolution, and it was like being in this fabulous family. It was just wonderful, Lisa.
It also sounds like it's kind of rich in terms of social life too, like you were sort of merging, you know, social with social justice and protest and, you know, doing things that mattered, I guess, with your friends.
That was exactly what it was like. It was like discovering the new tribe, my tribe. My girlfriend at the time, Kay, we were right in the thick of it, organising dances, doing designs for posters and T-shirts. And there's this great photo of me. I never realised it existed until a couple of years ago, of me just lying on the grass in the Botanic Gardens, and the look of ecstasy on my face, of just sheer joy and happiness. It's just fabulous. The long flowing locks, unblemished skin. I mean, it was just this, I was just in heaven. And now I look at it and I see this person not only is happy, but who's absolutely safe and secure. So this tribe just created this environment. So we had fun and frivolity as well as the serious side.
Was it a tribe that you discovered at university? And I'm assuming there wasn't too many other lesbian students in high school. So when you went to, is this correct in assuming that once you got to university, you found this tribe?
The tribe came around the name Gay Liberation. That's when lesbians like Barb Creed and others all came together. That's when I first met Peter McEwen, whom then I approached to join our board of the Victorian Pride Centre with his vast town planning skills. You know, it really were people, and John Davies, who was a dental student and is still a friend today, who lives in WA. Some friendships lasted a very long time, and then others with my professional life, then that moved on, Lisa, as well. So I was probably active with Gay Lib for, I reckon, 2 to 3 years, probably 3 years, and then my activities went into Melbourne University Student Union, the Australian Union of Students, and also the first homosexual national conference. That was, I think, 1975, AUS conferences where we passed motions about different things and organised around that, setting up with others the Gay Trade Unionist Group, the Gay Teachers and Students Group from 1977 to 79. So over a three-year period, I was the unbelievable coordinator for the elimination of sexism in education, which I did part-time for 3 years. Oh, my God. But anyway, I organised a contact network of 1,000 teachers, and I was taking on sexism about girls in schools and women teachers and everything that was discriminatory about them. They didn't have access to permanent part-time work or family leave. And anyway, it was full on, very energetic times. And those early days of Gay Lib really ended up going in different streams: homosexual law reform, activism on policy questions, and like the teachers' union, production of Young, Gay and Proud, consciousness raising on a big thing. Her coming out that started with Gay Lib, then just it really spread throughout society, really. It was just fantastic, that explosion in the 1970s of activism.
Jude, I'm wondering when you had time to study. What degree were you supposedly doing?
A BA. I limped through it, really. I didn't have a lot of time for study.
Did you have any plans about career when you were doing the BA?
No,
just kind of float through. And so what happened at the end of you? It sounds to me, Jude, that you were actually, while you were studying and attending classes occasionally, you were actually, the true study was what you were doing in lounges and organising. I can see that now that I know a bit about your career, I can see that that's where, you know, well, it goes back to when you were four. You know, I can see that that university study wasn't really about the classroom stuff. It was about what you learned outside of the classroom.
That's exactly right. Understanding how you could get groups together to pursue a campaign or to get a focus, organising people was really important. Phil Carswell tells the story with the 1970, you know, the 78ers.
Yep.
From a group of us Sydney. went from Melbourne Mardi to Gras. Sydney. And after one of those protests and the significant arrests, Phil tells the story, it was chaotic in the town hall, and I grabbed a microphone and organised people. So that's a little bit of a metaphor for what I have been over my life. I've been good at concepts and making them practical through organising things and looking ahead and seeing what might need to be done now to make that future happen.
I'm hearing big picture and little picture, which is pretty unusual. There's, you know, a lot of people are big picture but can't actually get things done. It sounds to me that you are an ideas person who actually sees it right through to fruition.
Yeah, but sometimes if the next big idea comes, maybe finishing is not as good and tidy as it could be. I've had to learn that discipline. So regime and discipline have also become, especially later on in my career, I moved from the slothfulness of lounge room chit-chat into a more disciplined, out of the smoke haze.
into the spreadsheets.
Into the spreadsheets and the discipline.
Hi, you're listening to Word for Word, and I'm chatting to Jude Munro. So what happened at the end of university then? You had all these amazing skills that you actually didn't learn in the class. You learned in lounge rooms and bars, probably. What happened after you finished, when you graduated?
Someone said, we'd really love you to join the Australian Union of Students and be a media officer, which I did. So I worked with Simon Marginson and Sandy Thomas. We became the three co-editors of a publication. And after that, I went for a couple of jobs. I remember going for a job with the Australian Council of Trade Unions and being interviewed by Bill Kelty, and he said, wow, but you're too much of a politician to do this job.
What do you think he meant by that?
Oh, because of my history with student politics. That's what he would have meant. I was very hurt. That's not true. I was a bit slighted. I also went for a job as a community development worker at the Hamilton in Victoria Community Centre. I didn't get that. And then there was this part-time job at the three Victorian teacher unions on dealing with sexism in schools. That was such a fabulous period, that 3 years. I was just like this burst of energy. So that then taught me community development skills, the further organising skills, and then I went for a job in Community Services Victoria. And so I worked for them for 11 years, and that was further rapid learning, concepts around child protection, regionalism, deinstitutionalisation, and my Director General at the time, later on, after I got some basic management skills, I became a regional manager within 4 years. And then I was on a trajectory through the department, and they asked me to do, and Peter Johnston, who's this fabulous Director General, he got me into running aged care in Victoria for 6 months, child development and care, like kinders and children's services for 6 months. And then I became a regional director. I had Kew Cottages as part of my responsibility. I had 1,600 staff, all through other people. I learnt how to bring an executive team together and create a dynamic executive team, some of whom are still my friends today. So that was also a very energetic time of fairly rapid institutional and social change as well. When you think about the lives of people who have an intellectual disability, and I personally learnt so much, Lisa, in that time. I learnt about the dignity of risk, and that's a concept that has stayed with me forever.
Tell me about that. What do you mean by the dignity of risk?
So the dignity of risk is that you don't assume that a person needs to be controlled in order to have the risk that they could do to themselves managed. You actually create freedoms for them so that they have control over their own lives. And my sister, who worked in an institution for people with an intellectual disability, just did this because of her nature. She got, instead of the hairdresser coming into that institution, she organised training and personal development for the women in her home, to be their home, to be able to catch public transport and go to a hairdresser and have a normal life through doing that. So it's a creation of a dignity of risk.
So the freedom to stuff up like the rest of us, basically.
The freedom to stuff up like the rest of us, and in doing so, to experience personal growth, to have independence and autonomy, to have a dignity associated, a dignity, a personal dignity that arises through considered risk-taking.
Do you think, if I say something to you like, we learn, not mostly, but we learn a lot about making mistakes? Is that something you can relate to in terms of the work you've done?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Learning things on the job, very much that. So in that period in Community Services Victoria, I'd never swap, because it was, they were heady times in terms of the degree of social change to some very static institutions. People don't realise, but it wasn't so much Kew Cottages, but Willsmere, which was next to it, which was for people who had a deep psychological problems, or apparently so. There was straw on the floor of buildings where people would be treated like animals, and they would urinate and defecate. And then in the mornings, that would be swept out like stables, and they were hosed down for showers. I mean, that wasn't a 1970s experience, but that's what had happened earlier. And our attitudes societally to people, to all people, have so massively changed. Probably the greatest social change is in the area of homosexual rights. That's really, through us coming out, that's in 20 years, a change right across the world. It's probably the fastest social change that's happened. But other changes, like the creation of rights and living conditions for people, have changed pretty massively. Some of that is to do with what I then got into around city management, about big systems, big sewerage systems and power and other system.
I think I know the answer to this question, but were you always out at work?
Yes.
And was it ever a problem?
No.
No. That's amazing, you know, given we're talking sort of 80s, 90s, 2000s.
Yeah, no, I was always out.
I think, yeah, the only person I've ever interviewed in here that has said, I've never had a problem being out at work.
No, I've never had a problem being out at work.
Talk me through the move into local government.
Louise, my partner, and we've been together for 35 years. I was sitting in bed, as you used to do on a Saturday morning, reading the paper, a physical paper.
Yeah, the actual
With
newsprint on your fingers.
And I saw this ad for the CEO of St Kilda Council, and I read it, and it talked about challenges in the environment and social challenges in St Kilda, and that they were wanting someone to be the CEO. And I turned to Louise and I said, I found a job for me. It's just got my name written all over it.
Surprised your photo wasn't next to it.
No.
In the paper.
Oh, my God, what an ego. Mm. Anyway, and Louise said, yeah, you can't do that.
Why, Louise?
And I said, oh, right, well, that's made me more determined. But unbeknownst to me, the wonderful St Kilda Council, they'd had their discussions and they wanted a woman as a CEO.
What year are we talking now?
We're talking 1990,
okay.
91. They would have had that discussion. There were four final people for that job. They were all women. One of them got it and it happened to be me. But one of the ones that didn't get it became a good friend of mine and I ended up recruiting her in to our senior team at St Kilda, and then she went on to become a fabulous CEO. So, you know, that's also a bit about passing on the baton and making sure that others get opportunities as well. But yeah, that St Kilda job, it was one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life. I just loved it.
Has there ever been a job that you really coveted that you didn't get?
No.
No industry that you would have loved to have worked in?
No.
No, you've done it all. I mean, you know, when I say done it all, we haven't done it all.
No, I haven't done it all.
But that's a pretty special place to be where you, all the jobs and the roles that you've had have been, you know, you're not sort of burning with a desire that, oh, I missed that job and I wish I'd had it.
Well, when I went through uni, I did some pretty amazing jobs. I remember working in a Collingwood factory, a couple of Collingwood factories. One was a light fitting factory where you made candelabra from imported Italian glass products. And another one was, it was this dyeing of cloth factory where you had to, me and the Greek women, pick up the edges of this cloth that was about 3 metres wide and then put them on rows of the pins that stuck up. And honestly, the end of the first day, my hands were covered in blood. Jesus. Because of doing this very dangerous work. But the other women who'd been doing it for years were very deft at it. But there was another piece of equipment in that same factory that were these 2-metre-wide rollers that swept in circular movements up and down. And if you got your arm in it, your whole body would have been mashed to pieces. And that was picking up cloth and folding it. If you've ever seen large bolts of cloth, you'll see that there's little tiny pin marks. And if you ever found one from about 1974, it would have had blood on the edge of it, you know. So some of the workplace health and safety conditions back were shockers, right? And so if you read historically about what children went through in Britain and that led to various law changes about that, I love reading about the big societal changes and how we've learnt. Sometimes also how we forget things, Lisa. The cure for scurvy was fresh fruit. That secret got lost out of society for 150 years through a cost-cutting measures and ended up being perfume of lemon that was given to people and, of course, put on their skin, got scurvy. So secrets can be lost. Great societal changes can be reversed. So I'm always one with homosexual rights is always be aware. Things can get lost. So we've always got to keep our edge up. Great societal changes can happen, but please never become complacent about that.
And I guess never assume that the past, because it was in the past, is foolish or is wrong or whatever. I mean, sometimes things that we learnt even hundreds of years ago are perfectly suitable to be used or applied today.
What sorts of things are you thinking of, Lisa, there?
I suppose, you brought up scurvy and just the simple thing of eating fruit. You know, I think there's probably lots of things around medicine or even just the way, you know, sort of farming and the creation of goods. Sometimes the old way, you know, the new way is not necessarily better than the old way.
I think excessive use of phosphorus and things like that, when in fact some of those old means of using composted material can have exactly the same benefit in agricultural terms.
And often we sort of go back to those things. I noticed in COVID that a lot of people went back to arts and crafts and they were knitting and, you know, making their own sourdough and all those sorts of things. And, you know, you sort of hope that COVID might, you know, usher those things back in, but, you know, who knows what's going to happen with that.
I suspect that that's the case.
I hope so.
Yeah, that there's some things that we've learned working at home, but also some of those precious skills are being rediscovered.
And people, I read last night that people are actually going back to sending Christmas cards, like actual writing, you know, purchasing Christmas cards and writing on Christmas cards rather than sending a text or, you know, posting on Facebook, which is, yeah, I really like the fact that we've sort of rediscovered a few things in lockdown. It's amazing. Mm. Now, tell me about moving out of St Kilda and out of Melbourne, and then you've worked in Brisbane and I think Adelaide. You've worked in quite a few cities in Australia in terms of your local government work. What was the impetus to drag Paul Louise off to another part of the world?
Oh, we discussed them each time. There were many good things on reflection that Jeff Kennett did, but the cutting of some basic services was I'd had enough, and I also want to test myself, and someone said, we'd love you to come and work at Brisbane City Council. And I was at Moreland at the time. I'd had responsibility for amalgamating Coburg Council and Brunswick Councils. I did that for a six-month period, then moved to Brisbane. I did a job up there as a divisional manager for 3 years and then went to Adelaide City Council to become the CEO there. And then Jim Sawley asked me to come back to Brisbane to be the CEO of Brisbane City Council, and that would have been in 2000. From probably 1990 to 2000, I worked across St Kilda Council, Moreland, Adelaide and Brisbane.
So you've bounced around a little bit,
but yep,
landed back here. Do you think you're back in Melbourne permanently, do you think?
Oh, yeah. This is home.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is home. But I have a saying, you know, love the one you're with too. So I really loved being in Brisbane, and we loved Adelaide as well. And what we found is each time we moved to a new city, we would spend quite a bit of time getting to know that area and exploring tourism-wise and just really enjoying it, Lisa.
Now, you and Louise have been together for 35 years.
Yes.
As you said. Tell me about that. Where did you meet, and how do you maintain a relationship for 35 years? What's the secret?
We met through community service. Well, we actually met at a radical socialist feminist conference.
Of course you did.
We did, back in 1981. So that's longer than 35 years. But we were both in other relationships at that time. And then there was a Christmas party and one thing came to another and we had a fling for a three-month period. Then we both went back to our partners. And then a few years after that, when both of our relationships were over, I was living in Melbourne, Louise was living in East Gippsland, and we started seeing each other again. That was about 1985, then we moved in together, then we bought a house in Ivanhoe, which is where we're living today.
Much changed
and redeveloped.
Are you married?
No.
Any thoughts on marriage? You sound like someone who maybe wouldn't want to jump into a patriarchal institution like that.
Uh-huh, you got it. Oh, Lisa, you're one of the few that goes really to that place. That's exactly it. But we have various phrases that we use. Like Louise says, we've only known each other 35 years. We wouldn't want to rush into anything. So that's her saying. And I just say it just sounds like too much trouble. All those parties and the organising for it. You know, I've got better things I can organise.
I've got a couple of gay friends in their 70s that have been together for, God, 40 years. And they, if someone says, how long have you been together? They say, oh, 3 months plus 45 years or whatever it is. So
that's gorgeous. Yeah, really no, cute. That's very special being able to do that. But we find that humour helps. So even when we'll have a tiff on something, one of us will see the funny side of it and then get over it quick.
I agree. Now, I think humour's a crucial element
of
a relationship.
It is. Yeah, and talking it through.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the Pride Centre. You're the chair of the Victorian Pride Centre. How did that come about? What was the impetus for us to have a Pride Centre, which is opening soon? All very exciting. What was the impetus behind developing a Pride Centre?
I think it probably came from a variety of sources. Ro Allen was very concerned about the lack of permanent accommodation. Here we are at Joy today, courtesy of the City of Melbourne, but they've got plans eventually for this building. And so that issue of impermanent temporary accommodation was a big impetus. Simon Ruth, he had seen from the CEO of Thorn Harbour Health, he'd seen information and maybe visited too, I don't know whether he had, but I think he had, different pride centres around the world, and Roe would have also been across that. So there was lobbying from within the sector, a new commissioner and a need, and then that turned into the burning platform and advocacy with the state government. And then I got asked, once they'd made that announcement, to chair the board.
Devil's advocate question. Why do we still need a Pride Centre when, you know, we're on the TV and we have equal marriage and we're in movies and we're reasonably visible? Why do we still need one?
Yeah, I think there's probably a few reasons for that. One is that one I talked about of coming out. The building itself is a visible statement that we're here. A second is the complacency question. There's always a need to organise. There are still trans and gender rights that aren't in place, recognition of the aspirations of intersex people, and I don't think there's still a need to come out, Lisa. I don't think that's changed. I don't think the struggle around coming out has completely disappeared. Even very accepting parents, one of my family, they recognise that their child may develop a sexual identity and views and have laid out that world. But even so, it's not, it's still an act of the individual. It's that thing that happens inside yourself that you then, it's internalised, it's not externalised, and then it has to be externalised. So that acceptance, full acceptance by society and complete understanding needs to be prompted. And, of course, the needs around accommodation, the need to have a catalyst for the identification of emerging needs in our community, the collaboration between organisations which can spark new and generate new organisations and energy, that can happen with the centre. Places where people who are really diffident about identity can come, see performances, explore a happy side of life, but also just feel supported in a safe environment. So I think there's probably many, many reasons to have a Pride Centre.
There's something to be said for being in a, just even in a building, in a beautifully designed building, I've got to say, just being in a building where there's like-minded people in the building with you. Mm. And I love your point about the organisations being in one place, sort of like a giant clubhouse, really. I think a lot of people thought that when we got equal marriage that was the end of it. We don't have to do anything anymore. And I think particularly heterosexual friends and our allies thought, oh, well, that's done. We can move on with something else. And I think we agree that the Pride Centre is sort of a monument to the fact that, no, we're not finished yet.
No, we're not finished
yet. And it's not a non-issue.
No, and I'm still coming out. I'm still, like, with my boards.
Day.
No, with my boards. Okay, I have to come out with my, any new board I join, I come out at it. But the surprising thing is the number of board directors that come up to me afterwards and say, my son is gay or my daughter is a lesbian and, you know, thank you.
There's something to be said for visibility, for sure. I speak to a lot of people in here that, you know, maybe, you know, senior generation, and the common thought is that, well, I didn't know that there was other gay people or other trans people or other bisexual people when I was 12.
No,
and
no,
I think
that's right.
Having a Pride Centre, which is a bricks and mortar representation of our community, is so important. Where do you see it in, say, let's talk about, where do you see it in 1 year and 5 years and 10 years?
Oh, wow, that's a big question.
I know. We've
so 1 year, I think we'll still be working out the operations of the centre, getting an annual calendar in place, the daily life of the Pride Centre from Pilates or yoga in the morning right through to cabaret at night. So there'll be lots of things happening there. And then I think in 5 years' time, I'm hoping that organisations that might have had their day, there's new ones coming along to replace them. And maybe that's more the 10 years out. But it's lovely seeing organisations like Joy evolve into the digital world. It's it's great to see Minus 18 become a national organisation with running formals in South Australia and New South Wales. So, Lisa, I think everyone is on their own growth path, and it's really important that we support some of the newer organisations that are emerging, and knowing that some organisations, just because we're all volunteers, they might only have a 6 month or 12 month life too.
That's fine. I mean, some, you know, organisations have done amazing things in short amounts of time. Do you see the ongoing funding of the centre to be a challenge? How's that going to work?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that we've spent a lot of time working out operational and finances. Our job has been to build the centre, but also to build coalitions of support, rings of support, and to create a milieu and programming that will lead to an active and vibrant centre. There are tenants, and there are at least four major tenants that are paying full commercial odds for their tenancies. And then there's gradations down, so that really an organisation like Joy is probably paying 25 to 30% of what would be regarded as, or maybe even less, commercial tenancies. So it's been structured in that way, and then we are publishing a pricing structure for pricing of the theatreette or some of the meeting rooms and that sort of thing, which would be have been priced according to what happens in other community centres, so that there's an equitable treatment there, but also an attractiveness of coming to the Pride Centre. So all that works out to be that plus philanthropy, and we've got an active program of raising funds, running events and that, but to try and keep out of the way of the resident organisations too and not duplicate what they do.
Yeah, that's a juggle, I guess, isn't it?
It is.
And it's, I guess, once it's open and those things start getting worked out, people sort of get the feel of how it's going to work, it'll be amazing. Let's finish by talking about future plans for you. So you're chair at the moment. Sounds like you're in it for the long haul. Are you going to travel? Are you and Louise going to move house? Have you got any personal plans that you haven't done yet?
Yeah, Louise semi-retired when she was about, I think, 57, so she's enjoyed that for some years. She volunteers with a number of programs teaching English as a second language, and Louise also works as a supporter in victim support with family violence at Heidelberg in the court system that's run through Red Cross. She has an active life doing that and also enjoying long distance walking. So that's her goal, is to continue to do long distance walking. I love learning languages, and for some years revisiting French, but from time to time I revisit other languages as well. I'm still active on other boards, so I'm on the board of Newcastle Airport, Metro Tasmania, which runs the buses in the urban system in Tassie, and I'm chair of Uniting, VicTas, which runs a lot of community services across Victoria and Tassie. All of that keeps me busy, and so I will have a program in the course of the next 2 or 3 years of winding those back. So I've got my program, and probably when I'm about 72 or 73, I might hang things up. But it's annoyed me to see the sexism against Joe Biden. Not the sexism, the ageism against Joe Biden in this presidential campaign that's just been. Yet I love the United States system of supporting people. The ageism has happened in Australia against Joe Biden, not in America. In America, there's not really a deep questioning about senators working through till their 80s or 90s.
Yeah, from what I've seen, it's more a question of health rather than age and, you know,
it should be.
You know, mental acuity.
It should be that. Yeah, so I support that. So Louise has actively encouraged me to not retire.
I think you'd be bored, Jude.
This is a general view, yeah.
I think
that Louise would share that view, that it's a bored Jude is not a good Jude.
No. I don't want to ask what you think you'd be up to if you were bored. Jude Munro, you have, from a very early age, like around four, been active and an organiser and a bringing of people together, an incredible organiser. And I just want to thank you for coming in to chat to me today about your personal life and your career adventures and sexuality and coming out and the future of the Pride Centre. Good luck with the opening of that coming up very soon, and thank you so much for everything you've done for us.
Lisa, thank you for the way that you run these programs. I know how much they mean across regional Australia, but also within Melbourne in particular. It gives people a great opportunity to understand other people's lives. I wish we could all listen to other people's lives. There's so much learning.
Thanks, Jude.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.
Stars at night, fashioned by divine.